Welcome, Darren Carey.
Thank you, Anita. I really appreciate that. So, it's like Anita said, I've been doing this for 20 years. I started off like a lot of you, sitting in the back of the room, learning how to do this, realizing I had no idea what I was doing, even though I'd done a few, and learning along the way, and improving, and getting better, and doing all of that. Now, so I started off as a landlord. I learned very quickly how to rehab houses because I hadn't figured out how to pick tenants yet. So I got good at that. Then I found out that you could actually deliberately buy a house and rehab it and sell it for a profit. And that started helping. Then I found out you could buy a house and not have to rehab it and sell it for a profit. So that was even better. But along the way, because I was always looking for private money, I was trying to bring the money in to get my deals done. So for me, it was always about, I need to find the money. I got to find the contractors. Now back 15 years ago, finding deals was easy. They were everywhere. Now it's a little harder. So I got really good at that, and as we made some profits, we gradually started, you know, people started hitting us up for a little bit of money for their deals. So we started just doing a little bit of private lending here and there, helping some people out, helping them get started. And then it started going a little more, and then a friend of mine actually asked me if, hey, I want to get into the note space, I want to do that, can you help me? And so he started this little mortgage brokerage at Dayton Capital. Now, he didn't want to be in charge. He just wanted to be a loan officer, do loans. But he moved to Tennessee after a year, and now I'm left alone. And I have Joe, wherever Joe went. And I have Susan out there and Joyce. Joyce is fantastic. And so it kept growing a little bit from there. And that little mortgage brokerage, how many people here knew Tom Bogle, who very sadly passed away last month? He was one of the people that helped me get this set up the way it is by simply asking me a question at the RIA. He came up to me at Cincinnati RIA and asked, hey, I've got this $90,000 in my IRA. Can you help me get it out there? And it took me about 2 seconds for the wheels to turn and click. Say, yeah, I can do that. I'm already doing that. And so we did that, and we helped him out with that. Exactly 2 weeks later at the next RIA meeting, another person came in and asked me, said, hey, I've been a private lender for years. Some bonehead just called me at 10 p.m. on Friday night and wanted to talk about a loan. I am tired of dealing with the people. Can you take care of that part and I'll just buy the notes from you? It's like, well, yeah, we can do that. We know how to do that. He goes, oh, and by the way, I don't want them to know who I am. It's like, I'm not sure how to do that one. So we got our local attorney, Ben Bauer. He came in and he helped us put together the personal property trust. And that's kind of how we ended up where we are today. Is we're out there, we're the front end, we're doing all that front end work, getting the borrowers out, and finding the borrowers, vetting them, vetting the deals, and putting them in the trust so you can buy the notes on the back end, maintain privacy, and because of the trust, you can even buy part of a note and still share in that first position. Because traditionally, when you did partials, you ended up in like a first, second, third position. But now you just share in the first position. If you have 10% of a performing note, you have 10% of first position. See, now I've told you everything that's in the entire presentation. And my clicker doesn't work. Yeah, pretty much. Just go look at the board. Yeah, we'll be fine. No, and my computer doesn't want to work. Oh, now I got to do it that way. There we go. So we kind of summed that up. By the way, I hate PowerPoint, just in case you guys are wondering. So all of you came here because you're really looking for one thing. You're looking for that passive income. Because if you're in the active side, it's busy, it's work. Trust me, it's work. Okay? But some of you I've talked to, you already know buyers, you're already doing things like that. Some of you are already private lenders, you're already in that business. Some of you are just kind of curious about what we're doing, or you're looking for a way to diversify, or maybe you're already a landlord and you're like, yeah, you know those tenants, we can do a few less of those. So that brings you here. Now, I need to get a basic definition out of the way first. So everyone refers to mortgages, notes. They are actually two different things. So the note is the promise to pay. The note says, I'm borrowing X dollars, I'm going to pay you this much interest, I'm going to pay you back on this schedule. So that's what the note says. The mortgage simply says the property is collateral. If you don't pay me, I get to take your property. So that's it. But the two pieces have to work together because you can very easily have a note without a mortgage.
But you can't have a mortgage without a note. Let's see, I think we covered that already. So you can buy the existing notes, you get the interest, but one question that always comes up is, why do we sell the notes? It's because as word got out that we were doing the hard money lending and at the RIAs and things like that, they tapped me out really quickly. And so people like Tom and the others start coming in buying notes on the back end, and so that kind of became a really good model. One of the questions I always get is, do I get to cherry pick the notes? And the answer is no. So the rule is, when we do a loan for somebody and that note comes in, we make that note available to all the people that are on our list of passive investors. And once I've sent it on that list twice, then I get to keep it. Which is fine for me, because I won't originate a note that I'm not willing to keep. So that's okay. So I just got to give you guys first dibs. And then whatever you don't want, you don't take, for whatever reason, I get to keep it. So the reason you're doing this is you want to be hands-off. You're not trying to be active. You're not out there swinging hammers. You're not dealing with tenant phone calls. You're not dealing with the contractors on a day-to-day basis. I mean, who's having an easy time getting contractors nowadays? Nobody? Exactly. And I got tired of babysitting people who were supposed to be grown-up, responsible adults, because many of them weren't. So I was like, well, this is better. The rehabber, the landlord, they can deal with that. They'll make the big chunk of the money. I'm just going to make a little bit on the back end, but I'm not having to do any of the work. And the fun part is, once you get into the notes, you can do it from anywhere. Now, if you're overseeing a rehab, it's really hard to oversee a rehab if you live in California and rehab's in Ohio. That's a really hard thing to do. Frankly, I don't like overseeing rehabs if they're a half hour away from my house. So the advantage here is you can do this from anywhere. It's all electronic. So I think we kind of hit that. If you're a rehab or a landlord, you have a very active hands-on business. If you're a private lender, you have an active hands-on business. If you're a note investor, you get to be passive. So as a note investor, let's try to stay out of the way. He's taking pictures now. So as a note investor, you want to work with somebody who knows what they're doing. So there's a lot of ways you can go out on the secondary market and buy a note. A lot of those notes are out there for a reason. A lot of times we refer to them as bad paper for one reason or another. The person went into default. They haven't made payments. It needs to be made reperforming. It was done by somebody, a homeowner, who didn't use an attorney. So the paperwork itself may be flawed, or there's issues. And that's why a lot of those notes sell at discounts. So you can go out there and find those notes selling at a discount, and you can do that, and you make good money at it. But that's a very active business. And if you want an active business, that's a great way to tie that into here. But it's not a hands-off, passive business. It's not a way to do it and just sit at home. And I used to call it mailbox money, but we don't send checks anymore. It just goes via ACH. It just shows up in your account. Much easier that way. And it's faster. It doesn't get lost in the mail. Occasionally it gets lost in the equity trust bottles, but they'll find it eventually. So it's out there. So you're able to come in there and you can look and say, oh, I like this house, or I like this borrower. And you can pick and choose what you want. And then once you pick that note, we're going to take care of all the servicing. So we're not just going to say, hey, congratulations, you bought a note. Here you go. Have fun. You know, so we're going to take care of all that day-to-day stuff. The borrower never knows who you are unless you tell them. So you could be sitting here at OREA in the room, sit right next to the guy's deal that you funded. Unless you tell him it was you, he won't know. Although you can have some very amusing conversations when they don't know that. That's a lot of fun. And then you get those monthly interest payments. Come on, computer help. So you guys, do you know what a mortgage fund is, a bond fund? You buy those Wall Street if you got traditional. So ours are very different. We're focusing intensely on the specific deal, that specific borrower. So the funds, those mortgage funds, they're set up so that they do a lot of mortgages in there, and they expect certain ones to go bad, but the overall average is going to be good. I want things set up so that none of them ever go bad. Unfortunately, it will happen. And it does happen. It's happened in the past. We'll talk a little more about that. But this gives us high levels of scrutiny on that specific borrower. If you're borrowing money from me, I'm going to get to know you. I'm going to know your project. I'm going to know what you're doing. I know what your skill set is. What have you done? Does this project fit in? Do you have the experience? Can you do this? So we're only going to look and lend to people who are investors. I don't lend to owner-occupants. They have a different mindset. They want somewhere to live. An investor wants to make a buck. So total different mindset. So I want business people. They're fix and flippers. Sometimes it's a wholesaler who's doing a wholesale deal. It's a landlord who wants to buy the property, get it fixed, and then refinance it. I want those business-minded people who are treating it like a business. And that's everything I look for. People don't realize when they first call me on the phone, as soon as they say hi, they're in an interview. Most of them have no idea they're already being interviewed. And some of them will never get invited to do an application for various reasons. So as I'm talking to everybody, I'm automatically listening to what's your experience level, what are you doing, what kind of projects are you looking for, what do you have to bring to the table? And I'm always doing that. I'm looking for the answers to just two questions. I only need to know the answers to these two questions. Is the deal good enough to fund? And is the borrower good enough to fund? If you've been around the old school hard money concepts, they always say it's about the house, it's about the house, it's about the property. That's a bunch of bull. It's about the person. The person is running the project. The person is finding the contractors. The person is making sure everything is going on day to day. The house is just the backup plan. That's just if something goes wrong. I have a backup, so I have security for the money that I've loaned to the person. So we very heavily scrutinize that person. So we're going to go through, breaking that down to a few more steps, we're going to go through, we're going to evaluate the borrower first. If the borrower doesn't pass that stage, they're already done. I don't care about their deal. The next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the property. How does this property look? Does this property fit? Does it make sense? You know, what's it look like? What does it need? Where is it located? Does it fit with your exit strategy? And then I'm going to look at the deal they've put together overall. Because they could have a good borrower, it could be a good property, but may not be a good deal. So that part has to fit in. I'm going to finish all that due diligence. And then I'm going to look at what skin in the game am I getting from the borrower. Because we make the borrower, they have to have at least 25% of that purchase price of their own cash in the deal. I will take equity in other properties too. That's okay. We're flexible. We are investors after all. But they've got to have skin in the game. This whole, oh, the deal's good enough, you can do it with no money down? No. Because I looked back when I started out, that was what I thought. That's what I believed. And I looked back, and out of the first 8 deals I did, 6 had problems. 5 of them had people with no money in the deal. Everybody who had money in the deal, they got it done. And the one person did. They had no money in the deal. They did a fantastic job. They got it done. But that commonality was, if they had no skin in the game, they were the ones that had problems. So we just don't lend to them as a lender. Now, I might do something with them as an investor. I might do some kind of a JV deal or an investor deal or, you know, elephant whale or something else like that with them. But that's not as a lender doing notes. That's the crazy real estate investor hat. So we kind of separate those out. So when I start looking at the borrower, I'm going to dig into their credit. Now, everyone talks hard money. You don't do it, look at credit. Oh, yes, we do. Now, honestly, I really don't care what their score is. Unless it begins with a 4, it takes work to get down to that level. What I'm really looking for is, what's your payment history on what you have out there? Do you make your payments on time? Now, if they have collections from AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, I don't want to deal with them. Okay, they're irresponsible. They're not going to be my end. But, I mean, I deal with a lot of people. They're rehabbers. Boom, their credit score bounces from, you know, 596, 620 up to 720, depending on how much they've maximized on their Home Depot, Lowe's, and Menards cards. So that always bounces up. But they're always making their payments. They're managing their money well. So we're looking at that. I'm looking at their background. Do you have a track record of success? Do you have some kind of a track record that gives me an indication that you're going to do well? Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be that, oh, I've been an investor for 20 years. They might be doing their first deal. But have you succeeded in something else? Or are you 50 years old and you've never done anything in your life? You're probably not a candidate for a loan at that case. I might do something with you because you're a good person, but now we're back to that crazy real estate investor side. So we keep those two pieces separate. So their experience, it could be zero experience. It could be decades of experience. What I'm looking for in the experience is, does your experience level, does that match the project you're doing? If it's a first-time borrower doing their first deal, they are not going to do a heavy foundation replacement. That's just not going to happen. I might help them wholesale the property to somebody else who can do it. Maybe do something like that, but I'm not going to lend them that for that. I did make an exception for one guy, but his family had a history of moving houses to new foundations. It's like, okay, you can probably handle this. And he did. He did really well with that. So I want to match it up. You know, your first time borrower, I want them to be doing something they can succeed at. It's, you know, I used to call it a grandma special, which is, you know, grandma lived there for 50 years. She took good care of it, but she was on a limited income. Everything is 50 years old. Needs a new kitchen, needs a bathroom. It might need a roof, windows. It might be a lot of stuff, but it's easy stuff. Now, replacing a roof, even if it's a $20,000 roof on a big house, it's not that complicated. You get three roofing bids, you find the guy, and make sure he's insured and bonded, and boom, you go. It's not that hard. Doing a foundation, solving water problems, water penetration issues, those are a bit more complex. And if I'm going to lend to somebody like that, I want them to have a level of experience in dealing with the things that come with properties. So what I'm looking for in those borrowers, I'm looking for people who are going to succeed. And I'm going to help them succeed and get through it. Again, like I said, they've got to have cash. They've got to, I'll take cash, I'll take equity. A couple of guys, they have free and clear rental houses. And they always buy houses because that's what they do. They go do a refi, they have cash, I'm going to slow down. And they, oh, by the way, I bought two houses last week. I thought you said you were slowing down. Well, they were good deals. And then he calls me up and says, hey, I need money. All right, which free and clear house are you putting up this time? What did you go by? So we're flexible. But again, we want that skin in the game. Now, as much as I like some people, I'm just not going to give them the 100% loan. It's not going to happen. And I would never put that out to you guys. So we look at the property. I said, I've been doing this for 20 years. I'm going to look at that scope of work. Is it appropriate? Is the costing appropriate? If someone says, hey, we're just going to swap out the HVAC system, it's a $9,000 bid. Wait a minute, that's just a furnace and air conditioner. That should be like closer to five, maybe a little under. It's like, oh, well, it had, you know, it's all the ductwork has to be replaced. And we have to get rid of the old octopus in the basement. Oh, that'll raise your cost. Now, on the other hand, if they tell me they're getting a whole new system for $800, I want to know what truck that fell off of. You know, so does it match? Does it match the plan? If they're doing a $300,000 house and they tell me they're putting in the, you know, Menard special laminate, we're going to have a discussion because that's not appropriate for a $300,000 house. It's like, which granite guy are you using? So those are the things we want to look for. We want to make sure it's going to match up. And we make sure their after-repaired value matches what we think it is. So if you come and say, hey, this is a $300,000 house, and I look at it and say, well, nothing in that neighborhood sold for more than $220 in the last year, I'd say, yeah, but mine's going to be special. Okay, well, let's talk about special. Okay, so let's bring you back to reality. So we want to look at that. And then once we go through there and they've done their project, does it fit their exit strategy? If they're going to sell the property, is this in a neighborhood where it's going to sell? Or are they doing a little inexpensive property and trying to hit first-time homeowners? If they're doing that, and that's, it's still a good market, but what's your backup plan if you can't find that first-time homeowner? Does it still work as a landlord? Could you sell this to a landlord also? And so, or are you going to refi it and keep it as a rental property? So I want to make sure they always have a feasible exit so that when they get the rehab done, they're not stuck. They didn't back themselves into a corner. So we don't want to talk about that guy. So, and again, like I said, one more thing is, even though I'm doing everything I can to make sure these people are good, they're doing good projects, the deals make sense and everything else, deals are going to go bad. You know, the first few I did, they went bad because I hadn't learned all this stuff yet. And it's been, the last time one went bad was 2017. Okay? But I'm doing enough that I promise it's going to happen again. And it's probably going to be a good person that something unexpected happens in their life, and all of a sudden they can't finish the project. You know, I had one guy who gave him the deed back because his elderly mother in Florida all of a sudden needed him there. So he just gave me the deed and said, I'll come back in a few years, we'll pick up where we left off. Great, I can work with this guy again. Then you get the guy that says, no, I'm not going to pay you back, and I'm going to take all the kitchen cabinets out of the house and take the appliances, and you can go stuff it. That didn't work out well for him either. He took that property back, and all that stuff was still in there, and the cops trespassed him off the property, and we had all kinds of fun. So that was interesting. But you understand, as an investor, even though it's passive, even though we're still in the middle doing it, there's always a risk that something is going to go wrong. If that risk scares you, this is probably not where you want to be. But if you can accept that, yeah, there's a chance it's going to go wrong, we may have to take a property back. That's going to take some time. Now, most likely, the way we've got it set up, the most likely scenario if we take a property back is we're going to get the principal back and we're probably going to about break even. That's the most likely scenario. Might make some money on it, might wholesale it off to somebody else, do a rehab, or maybe you bought the whole note. Maybe it's like, oh, just give me the property, I'll keep it. We can do that too. But that's kind of our last resort. Remember I said the house is the backup? This is the backup plan. If I can't get the person back on track, if I can't get them to fix it, to find the contractor, or to be able to find a place to order windows, or help fix whatever got them off track, I'm going to try to do that first. Taking the property back is always the last resort. I think we already covered evaluating the deal with that whole thing, so I'll let you guys look at it. So I'm going to look at these questions after I've talked to them. What is good and bad about this? I know I'm right in your way. What is good and bad about this borrower? What is good and bad about this deal? What's good and bad about this property? And how's my gut feel about this person or this deal? Is something a little like, yeah, I don't know, something just doesn't feel right? I start digging even deeper. So we've managed to identify some people before they ever got a loan that were involved in fraud. They've made the evening news in Cincinnati, other things like that. So we want to try to get those things out of the way and figure it out. We had the guy recently was all of a sudden, it's my deal. Oh, no, you can't pull my credit. It's my partner's deal. And so I started talking. I was like, okay, it's very clearly you're part of the deal. I don't care how you structure it, but you're part of the deal. And I asked him, hey, if I looked into your background, is there anything I'm going to find that should concern me? Oh, no, that's fine. And he kind of dodged the question. So I asked him again, hey, if I did, check your background, is there anything that, any skeletons in the closet I should know about? And he dodged the question. And a few minutes later, I asked him essentially the same question. Is there anything I should know about in your background? So he keeps telling me that, I'm just going to refine my house. I can't have it mess up my personal residence. And again, he said, no, it's fine. There's nothing out there. Oh, what about that conviction for federal fraud? And he goes, oh, that. Because I've already done the checks. Because that little gut feel was like something was off. So, yeah, needless to say, they didn't get a loan. So once we've gone through that and we've given the deal the go-ahead, now we're going to coordinate the closing. We always do a title search, making sure title's clear. We always get lender's title insurance. We make sure there's property insurance. We make sure that insurance names us as an additionally insured. Also make sure we get these little notices if they miss a payment. Make sure all the loan documentation is right. The mortgage is done. It's recorded. Little important details. They've signed the note. Doesn't match. Did the title company do it correctly? Occasionally we have a problem with that. Okay, I see you smiling over there. And then we move into the servicing phase. This is where we're going to take those monthly payments in from the borrowers. So on the first business day of the month, I reach out to their checking account and I take all my payments in. About 3 days later, I look and see if anybody bounced. And I may have to make a phone call. Usually I make the phone call and they go, oh crap, I forgot to put money in that account. Give me a couple minutes, you can take it. That's generally how that goes. And then, 5 business days later, so this month it was the first, I pulled all the money from their accounts. Normally by today I would have checked and made sure they didn't bounce, but I've kind of been here. So I have to do that Sunday night. And then Monday I'll go out there and I'll push all the interest payments out to all the note investors. So the note investors will see that on the 8th or the 9th, and all their interest payments will show up out there. So we just simply process it through there. When they need to do a draw, they come back to us and we take care of that draw. We make sure, what have you done? Is it finished? Did we get a release of lien from the contractor? Is the work done correctly? Little details that are important. And then we'll go and process that draw for them, because when they have the rehab funds, we hold those funds. They don't get them. You're doing a $100,000 rehab. You think I'm going to give a $100,000 check at closing? Uh-uh. It's going to my account. And as you get work done, you can pull that down. So I mentioned earlier about, you know, that shared first position and keeping privacy going. How many people already know what a land trust is? About half of you? Okay, so a personal property trust is exactly the same as a land trust. The only difference is a land trust holds real estate, it holds a deed. A personal property trust holds a mortgage and a note. So by doing that mortgage and note, we've accomplished 2 things at once. One, it puts me on the trust as the trustee, so I am personally responsible for running that trust. The second thing it does is it keeps you anonymous, which is why you use a trust. Nobody knows who the beneficiaries of the trust are, so like I said, you could be sitting next to them in the room and they don't know. So you have the privacy that you want. The most important thing to me, though, beyond that, is that having that trust in place, I can break that note up via the trust, doing the beneficial interest, and you can have part of it. So you three could all have part of the note, but instead of being in first, second, and third, you're all sharing in first position. That way, if something does go wrong and we have to take it back, somebody in third doesn't get wiped out to zero. So for me, that's really very important. The other thing is, because it's simple and easy to use, it allows you to do these notes with smaller amounts of money. I've got some people who just opened up brand new CISAs and HSAs. They have, you know, CISA, you only put in $2,000 first year. So they can get those started. They can do a little partial with that. And sometimes they'll mix in, like, I've got one family. They have 5 accounts. And they usually put it all on one note. The husband and wife each have an IRA, both kids both have a CISA, and they have an HSA. And they'll go look at it and say, they just look at it as a total fund. They say, we got X dollars. They say, oh, we want to put it all on this one note, because that's the way we want to do it. And I keep all the paperwork straight on my end so that we have it broken up by 5, all the interest payments go to the right account, and we keep track of it for them. But it allows them to participate with accounts that have smaller numbers. There is not an official minimum. $20 is not enough, though. Now, most people start off, honestly, I think, even though there's not an official minimum, I kind of like the CISA accounts. I like working with those. But, yeah, starting off with a few grand and more is good. It's a way to go. I think, if so is the median, whatever those statistics terms were. Most people seem to start out around 20, 25, 30. I guess some people will jump right in at 100, 150, 200. Some people only have 5K to work with. And that's fine, because I'm happy to work with you. Because when I was young and getting started, I was really impressed myself when I was about 22, because I had saved $3,000. Okay, and I was 22, and I was like, yeah, I was impressed. And I started trying to invest it in something. This is, you know, okay, age warning. This was before you had online brokerages like E-Trade, Ameritrade, and all that other stuff. And I was trying to get it invested in something. And nobody would talk to me. I needed to have $10,000. Like, oh my God, it took me 3 years to get to here. And I couldn't do anything. And that just annoyed the out of me. And so when I got to the point where I could start bringing in note investments, things like, well, I mean, that pissed me off. What can I do to help? Can I make this simple? Can I make it so that I can still cover the overhead and still help them out? And when I'm helping somebody out with a $2,000 CISA, I'm not making any money at that. I'm just helping somebody out. That's what we're doing. So let's see. I think I talked about draws. Didn't I do that? So draws. Oh, sorry.
What's a CISA?
Oh, CISA is an educational account, Coverdell Educational Savings Account.
Okay. And then the difference again between the land trust and the personal property trust, the land trust holds a deed.
A land trust holds a deed to a property. That's the reason it's called a land trust.
Right.
A personal property trust holds a mortgage and a note or something that's considered personal property.
And the reason in both cases is this anonymity that no one knows what's in a land trust. They don't know who holds a property.
Correct, because the trust has a trustee. The trustee is the public owner of the trust. Their name is out there in the front. The beneficiaries are private. Nobody knows who they are. Now, a lot of landlords are using land trust. They're the trustee and they're also the beneficiary because, well, that's what landlords do. But they're not doing it so much for that level of privacy. But that's why it's out there that way. The trustee is the public piece.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, Scott?
I know that Lake City Servicing charges me like $10 a month servicing fee for the note I purchased for that.
That's relatively cheap.
Well, actually, that's what my grandfather said.
Oh, now it's $20. Okay.
Anyway, the question is that if someone has like five accounts, would that be like five different accounts? Likely to have a service fee for each one of them for your process.
I don't charge a servicing fee. So when you look at the board out by our table that says there's notes and it says there is a 10% yield, that is a true 10% yield to the note buyer. I've already covered it. I'm charging the borrowers 12%. I'm putting the notes out at 10%. That 2% spread covers all the office overhead, all the draws, doing the release of mortgage, and taking care of all that paperwork. That's what I say, 2% on a $2,000 account. I ain't making any money on that. I'm just helping people. But that's how we do it. So I want, when I advertise it out there, I want to make it easy. So you look at, oh, it's 10%, it's this, it's this. You don't have to calculate in, oh, I've got a $20 service charge or a $35 service charge. I'm not going to do that to you. The one thing you do have to watch out for is if you're using a custodial account, like a self-directed IRA, depending on your custodian, they may or may not have a transaction fee. And you need to be very aware of that, especially if you're working with smaller dollar amounts. You know, a transaction fee on a $100,000 note, okay, it's a very small impact. A transaction fee on a little $2,000 or $5,000 CISA account, that could wipe out, you know, a month or two of interest. So you need to be aware of that, and if you're going to do accounts with smaller notes, then you need to make sure you're picking the custodian correctly and take that into account. They don't charge you for deposits, but they'll charge you to make the investment and close the investment. So it gets interesting. So you need to understand, and a good thing is if it's a personal account, you don't have to worry about it. You don't charge yourself. But again, the different custodians, you have to be aware of what their fee structure is. Mark's been asking a lot. Where did Mark go? I thought he was just pointing over here, but yeah.
Initially, yes. The question is, so the trust provides anonymity, but it doesn't also provide any protection from liability if...
No trust ever provides any protection from liability. A land trust does not provide any protection from liability. As the note holder, your liability is virtually zero. Because you're a passive investor. You have no responsibility for the property. If the property burns down, you're simply the mortgage holder. Well, I'm technically the mortgage holder because you're the beneficiary of the trust. So they would have to somehow go out and say, oh, it was committed fraud in the origination. Well, wait, that's not on you, that's on me. So, I mean, I've talked to attorneys about this, and I haven't found an attorney yet that's told me, oh, you're liable for this. And I've got attorneys that are buying the notes from me this way. Way over there. Yes. Yeah, you can combine all those because you're not... So the prohibited transactions is if you're buying and selling from, say, a personal account to an IRA. But you can take and run in parallel. You can take on one note or multiple notes, use an IRA, an HSA, personal funds, or your LLC because you're not managing it and you're not selling to each other. So, yeah, we have actually a lot of people that do that, that mix those various accounts together that way. Way in the back.
So the notes that you're selling, this is money that you've lended out to people. So you're not buying these notes?
No. Every note I put out there, I have originated. Every single one of them. I've already funded them.
So, I was heard in some states you have to have a license.
Yeah, various states have licensing requirements. Those focus on owner-occupied properties. So, like in Ohio, for example, where I do most of my business, if you want to lend to an owner-occupant, you have to have an NMLS license. If you want to service a note that is for an owner-occupant, you have to have a license with the state. They figure businesses don't need to be, you know, protected from all those kind of things. So a business-to-business transaction is not regulated for those things. So to originate a note, I don't need a license to do it to an investor. To service a note to an investor, I don't need a license for that. So there's the distinction is between who is the person that is using the property. Is it a personal use or is it a business use? Personal uses or consumer protection laws, they are, as you know, generally heavily regulated in most cases. Businesses in general are not nearly as heavily regulated, unless you're in some of the nanny states like California. They're all crazy. Way in the back now. Yes, every note has a different trust. So it keeps it very easy. And it's very simple. If I do one on, you know, 174 Hedges Avenue, it's the 174 Hedges Personal Property Trust. But that way every trust is dedicated, and I can very easily track who my beneficiaries are of that trust for that note. Because you may be in three or four or five different ones. And it gets way complicated if you try to put every one big trust. I like it simple. Hold on, Randy's been at.
So if I'm a beneficiary of investing one of the notes, who's the trustee, and what is my recourse if the trustee does some bad stuff?
I am personally the trustee.
You're the trustee.
I am personally the trustee. Bad things really happen to me if I screw up as a trustee. It is not pretty. But yeah, as a beneficiary, you do have recourse against the trustee. So if the trustee, you know, says, hey, look at all this money, I'm going to Rio. Oh, wait, I don't speak Portuguese. Yeah, you would have recourse against that. You would go through the trustee. Trustee goes to jail, pays lots of money. You get properties, and it's really ugly. I don't want to go there. I don't look good in orange or stripes or any of that other kind of stuff. This is way too much fun doing it like this.
What if something happens to you? What's the backup plan?
She's standing right over there. Yeah. So, his successor trustee, also known as wife. So, the backup plan beyond that is I actually got it confirmed Ben Bauer still wants to be my backup plan because he set up the trust initially for us and he was always the backup plan if something happened to both of us. I haven't talked to him. He moved to another firm. He's got a family and a life. I just kind of need to get to the life part of it. But I just need to confirm with him that he's still on board with that. And I suspect he probably is. He's an attorney, so he's not going anywhere. So, yeah, so Christina's the backup plan. If something happens because we happen to be together a lot, something happens to both of us, then Ben Bauer in Cincinnati is our backup plan after that. And fortunately, Ben's been a real estate investor for a long time. He's an attorney. He knows what we're doing.
Texas too late trusts?
I would have to check on Texas for trusts. I haven't had need to look down there. I don't know that answer. Let's see. We've got a Tennessee attorney here, an Alabama attorney. I don't know if we have a Texas attorney here this time. All right, so let's see. All right, we killed the questions off. Who's got a time hack? Where am I at?
9:18.
Okay, I'm running out of time. All right, servicing. We have personal property trust. We mentioned that. This is not guaranteed. This is not safe. This is not FDIC insured. It is an investment. Oh, wait, what time is 9:15? Oh, I have till 10?
Yeah.
Oh, great. We have all kinds of fun with Q&A. I like Q&A. That's the fun part. So, like I said, if you want to do something perfectly safe, this isn't it. Go to the bank, buy a CD. Okay? Yeah, it's been since 2017 that we had something go bad. But like you're asking, you know, what if something happens to me? What if something happens to the borrower? You know, so there is always the chance something will happen. What I'm doing up front is trying to screen out the ones who are problematic to begin with. Okay, so typical hard money loan. Now we get a little more into the nuts and bolts of it.
That's like the Q&A.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I originated in 2017. So, and that was the last note I did where the person had very little money in the deal. Yep, I took it back at the end of 2017. It was about 6 months.
When you say money in the game or skin in the game, does that mean money they've actually physically put in, or the only way they're going to get paid is if the property sells?
So for these notes, they have physically put money into this specific deal.
Not just borrowed it from somebody else.
No, that doesn't count. They don't have skin in the game then. I will take it. If you had a free and clear rental property, I'll take that. No, that's skin in the game. You've acquired and built something, but they've got to have something in it. Now, somebody might be partnering with somebody else. So if you were partnered with Jess, and Jess was bringing the money and you were going to run the project and you're both in the deal, that's okay. If you're going to just say, hey, Jess, give me 25 grand so I can give him a down payment, not so much. We don't like that. It does help to know who's in your audience.
That's so interesting, because I bought a house once, and the bank really took me through the ringer to prove that the down payment that I was putting in was my money that they earned, that I didn't get from somebody else. And I never understood that. Why do they care where the money's coming from?
Right. Because we're in this game because we want interest payments coming back every month. I don't want the house. If I wanted the house, I'd just go buy one.
Yeah.
That part's easier. I don't have to go through foreclosure. I just go buy a house. I want to get paid back. That's it. I want to collect a little interest, and I'm good. Let's see. Down payment, at least 25% of the purchase. Now, I happen to be in Dayton, Ohio. We get some really inexpensive houses. So they've got it. So 25% of a $10,000 house isn't jack. So they have to put at least 12.5 down. I got it last month, bought a $10,000 house. It'll be worth about 120 when he's done. But because $10,000 on the purchase, that doesn't even cover the down payment. So the first $2,500 out of his scope of work, he's funding out of pocket. So there's his 12.5, and then I'm funding the rest of the rehab. So he's got his skin in the game that way. So that's their skin in the game. Like I said, I got some other people that they're always buying houses, and they'll throw a free and clear rental property up, say, hey, I need 25 down. I just bought a house. Here, I'll give you this rental property, and we'll put a mortgage on that one, too. And I'm good with that. You know, if they got a lot of equity there, that's skin in the game for me. It doesn't have to be Federal Reserve notes. We always make sure that when the project is done, they're going to be at 70% loan to value or not, or lower. Because they're doing a rehab. They're trying to get and create value to make a profit. If they're not creating value, if they're going to go in there and say, hey, I'm going to do this, you know, $40,000 rehab and I'm going to make 10 grand, I look at it and say, well, dude, just wholesale it and take your 10 grand and let someone else deal with it. Because I do that level of numbers analysis. You've got to be creating additional value when they're doing the rehab. So we want to make sure they're doing that. So we will almost always fund 100% of the rehab because that rehab money stays in my account. So if they're doing a $100,000 rehab, that's fine. I'm okay with that because that 100 grand sits in my account. As they get work done and submit draws, I reimburse them for the money they've already spent. So we're kind of protecting things that way. You got a question?
Do you ever take a second lien position, or are you always first?
Rarely. I will, and if I do, it's usually one I'm just going to keep. I have put one out there before on the note list, and I very clearly called it out. This is second position, highlighted in yellow and all that. And when I did that, and they had a $30,000 first. They were borrowing $50,000 on a $250,000 house.
Why didn't you just take out the first? That's the process. Lend them $80,000.
Because the first was at 3%.
Good reason.
So besides, I'm like, okay, let's see. The first is 30. I'm putting 50 on it. That's 80. The house is already about 200 grand. So it was in Nashville. But I'm good with that. I mean, logically, that makes a lot of sense. So for that, I'll make an exception. I'll do a second. I'm not going to typically do a second where, hey, we borrowed 75% over here and we want another 10 from you. Nope, not happening.
You've been talking about notes, investing in notes with you, but now you're talking about hard money loans.
It's
that's me putting it out, because I have to do the hard money loan to create the note for you to get. Generally, we're heavily Dayton, Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky. Northern Kentucky is just a Cincinnati suburb, despite it being in a different state. We do Columbus. We've done some West Virginia, some in Tennessee, a couple in Georgia. We just did one in Florida. So we are getting around.
So you can use boots on the ground.
Yep. Got to have boots on the ground. Got to have somebody doing that level of work. The reason we're doing Florida is wherever Joe went, he's hiding somewhere. Joe's moving to Florida, so he's going to be my boots on the ground in Florida.
Would you be willing to fund a deal in Kent, Ohio, if it's attached to a military service member, ROTC, going to college guaranteed?
Maybe. Maybe. Because remember, I know how that system works. She was asking about funding for a college student going to ROTC over at Kent State. The answer is maybe. So it's a lot of things, like, because remember, I have two sides. I have the one brain, which is, this is a hard money loan, this is a private loan, you must meet these criteria. Then I have the crazy real estate investor side that says, oh, that sounds like fun, we should do that.
Didn't you also say before that a person buying notes from you, they can't cherry pick the type of notes that they want to buy, or the locations?
Oh, as the note buyer, you can share whatever you want. So I will never tell the borrower who bought the note.
Cherry pick.
Well, yeah, oh yeah, I don't cherry pick.
Like, for example, I'm up in Cleveland.
Okay.
I want to buy a note for a property that's located up in Cleveland in case something went bad. And I had to, repossess that property.
Yeah, so when we do the note list, it has a picture of the property. It has the property address right on there. So if you're interested in Cleveland or areas up that way, like there's one on the board right now up in Tiffin. It was 40 minutes south of Cleveland or something like that. You know, so you can look at the address and say, oh, I want to be geographically, I live in Cleveland, I only want to do something here in this area of the state, and that's okay. So it's up to you to pick and choose. Some people only want to do, you know, little inexpensive properties because they like Section 8 rentals. If anything goes bad, they just want it. Other people only want to do nice properties in nice neighborhoods. Some people won't do any loan that's under 100 grand because, as he likes to say, it doesn't move the needle. So it's up to you to pick and choose. It's what fits your style, your desires, what you're looking for. That's why we give you a variety. It's up to you. We're not going to shoehorn in. This is the one thing we do. You must pick this. No, just give me your money. We'll pick what? No. No, you get to choose. I'm just the conduit. Yeah, Jen.
This isn't really a question. It's more of a thank you, because it does speak to the spirit of what you said before about wanting to help people. You helped me with my risk aversion by letting me do exactly what you're talking about, picking and choosing from your portfolio, spreading out my investment in smaller chunks and making my own mutual. And that's fantastic. Thank you.
You're welcome. Connie, hey, tell you what, we don't have a handheld. Jim, you want to repeat part of that? Because the other side of the room couldn't hear.
Well, what Darren's done for me, and it took me a couple years to warm up to this idea. On his board, you know, you get that in an email, what he has available. It's allowed me to cherry pick with the amount of money that I've invested, break it up into smaller chunks, and make my own mutual fund. And it helped me overcome my risk aversion, which, you know, I met you several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a couple years to warm up to the idea, but it's working out great. In fact, the only complaint I have, and it's really not a complaint, it's just more work for me. Fortunately, the only thing the bank will give you is more checkbook registers. That's what I've found. But because I've broken up my investment into smaller chunks in my own mutual fund, basically, every month I have to write my deposits in my register instead of one great big one. So that's really my only complaint, is it's passive, but it's not completely passive. But thank you. Thank you.
Okay. I'll pay you $20 later. Well, apparently he has a paper register because he's old school. Yeah. No, Jim's a good guy. So, Christina, Connie.
I've known Darren for what, 15, maybe 20
years? About 15.
Okay, and when he got into this business, I quit. And then I work 4 days a week. I'm a nurse, I work 4 days a week. I don't have time to deal with a lot of things. When he got into this business, I talked to him about it.
Can you hear me back here?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Gee, well, Kathy, are you saying I don't have a big mouth? I needed something that was passive and that I had someone that I could call and say, can you explain this to me? Can I do this? And it was Darren. And my husband even is on board with this. So it's just been a great passive investment that makes you money. And honestly, you go to bed every night and you don't worry about it.
Thank you, Connie. One of the, when I was a new investor, a couple of the first properties I bought were from Connie on land contract. That was 10, 12, 13 years ago.
Yeah, I have a question about the mechanics. So let's say you have a note and it's $100,000. So you put out to your list and you've got four people put in $25,000 each. So each of those becomes a beneficiary. Is that how you do that?
That is correct.
So you just revise the trust?
Yeah, we update the beneficiaries on the trust so you each reflect 25%.
Okay.
And what part of that paperwork we send you is an assignment of beneficial interest. So we cover it that way. Now we have microphones going around.
Now I'm curious about the people that you're helping. You know, I'd love to hear comments about that. It doesn't have to be in the main part of the presentation, but I'd love to hear those profiles.
You just got two of them.
No.
Oh, the borrowers. Okay, tell you what, hold that question for a little bit later. Bring that back up. I want to kind of cover through the presentation first.
I can address that.
Yeah.
Even if you want to be.
Okay, we'll a little bit later on that piece. I want to make sure I get the core info out, and then we can do Q&A until they kick us out of the room. Let's see. So we picked up on this. So 70% or less loan to value. We'll fund 100% of the rehab. We hold those funds in escrow, so they only get it as they get work accomplished. We write those for a 12-month term because I think all those lenders who write it for 6 months are just set people up either to fail or to pay additional fees when they do an extension at 6 months. As an investor, I didn't like that. As a lender, I won't do it. So 12 months gives them enough time to get there and get done. It allows a contractor to have to get fired, a deal to fall through, you know, the sale fell through, things like that. Because I want them to succeed and get through it. Now, on average, most people pay off right around 7 months or so. Some are 5 or 6, some are 8 or 9. I have one person that's on year 3. He doesn't care. He pays every month. It's rented. He's making money. He's happy. The note investor's happy. It's like, okay, let it roll. We're pretty easy. We're actually going to start a program for doing rental loans for people because we can do rental loans for people that have properties that are worth $100,000 or more, but it's a little harder to do it for properties that are under that. So we're going to be starting a program for people to do those you know, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 deals, and those will have 3 to 30 year terms. There's going to be a balloon in there, probably around the 5-year point, 7-year point. Those obviously the landlords are going to have a lower interest rate. They're probably going to yield more like 6, maybe 6.5%. But those are going to go very hands off for longer terms. You don't have to worry about it. So we've got a couple of people that are doing those, you know, the first initial test cases with me on that as they're doing that. But that will be coming along probably next year sometime. So again, why are we looking at the performing note space? It's because it's passive. You don't have to work for it except to fill out the deposits in the register. Okay? It's secured.
there is a backup plan. You've got that real estate as a backup. We never want to take the real estate because that's not why we're in the game. But if something goes bad, we can take it if we have to get ourselves reimbursed. I want that backup out there. I don't want tenants calling me. I don't want to hear that the toilet's plugged up and they, you know, because the kid put a tennis ball down it. You know, I don't want to hear about that. I don't want the phone call on Saturday night saying, hey, the furnace is out. Well, guess what? As a note investor, we never hear about it. Well, once in a while we hear about it at the bar, but we don't have to deal with it. So the borrower out there, the flipper, the landlord, they get to deal with all those active pieces, those day-to-day hassles. That's their job. That's why they make the big bucks. They can have all that work. We're going to be passive. We're just going to get little checks for doing nothing. And the fun part is because it's all electronic, you don't have to go tromping through houses. You don't have to write a scope of work. You can look at a summary on there. You can call me up and say, hey, can you tell me a little more about this guy or this deal? And we'll kind of go through it. And it gives you enough information. You can say yes or no. We do everything via email. So it makes it very simple. So I was down at John Heyer's class in Puerto Rico. I closed two loans while I was down there. And I sold one of the notes to a note buyer while I was down there. They were up here in Ohio, and I don't remember what the deal was. It was probably in Ohio. So it's very easy to do it from anywhere. Once upon a time, we were able to take a vacation. We were in Vegas. We closed a couple of them out there because it's set up to be portable. You can do it from anywhere. You can be on vacation in Hawaii and say, oh, my note paid off. Well, here, I'm sitting in the hotel room for a few minutes. Oh, I like this one. And then head out to the beach or go scuba diving, snorkeling, whatever you want to do. So we've designed it to be that way because we want to make it as hands-off for you as possible. Now, if you've got custodian accounts, like, let's say Equity Trust, who's right out here, we even fill out the DOI for you. We make it easy. So if you look on here, there's an email address, guide@DaytonCapitalPartners.com. And it's on the flyer that Joe, who disappeared again. Joe, hand out flyers. It's good to have minions.
You may have just lost these barrels.
So if you send an email to that email address, it's going to pop back. I set up an autoresponder before I came down here. It's going to come back with a website. There are two things on the website. One of those is a guide. It's about 12 pages long, give or take, and it kind of covers a lot of things we've already talked about, and I'm sure it covers some things I forgot to mention. So it gives you a good, easy read. It's something you refer back to, and honestly, it's mostly what these slides are based off anyway. Okay, the second thing on there is actually a PDF file with all the notes that I have on the board. That's on there, too. That's also on the website, so you can get a copy of the PDF. The one thing that's not on the PDF on the website is the ones where I've written pending and sold on the board there. That's not updated out there yet. Another thing that someone asked about,
I know about it.
When we put the note list out, which currently do it about once a month, we're working on getting a website up so where it will be up on a website. You'll be able to pull it off the website, click, choose, say, I want this one. Not quite there yet. The software turned out to be a little harder to implement than I expected. We're working on that. So we're still doing a little bit old school. We send out an email, and everyone just sends a response to the email, says, oh, I want this much on this one or this one, and here's my backups if that one's taken. And I just process the emails in order in the way they come back. And I just start at the top. Okay, send out the email. There's some people live on their phone, so I get responses back in 2 minutes sometime. People saying, oh, I want this one. And I'll just process them in order. And so if Mike comes back first and says, hey, I want 50K on this one, then Mike's got it. If Mark comes in after and says, I want, you know, all of that one, I say, sorry, Mark, 50K's already gone. Do you want the rest? Or should I go to your second choice? And we process them that way. That way everything goes through that way. Someone had mentioned cherry picking earlier, too. And I think I mentioned earlier, I always put every note out. I don't hold anything back. Okay? So the only things I keep that I don't put out there are my crazy real estate investor deals. I keep those in because they're crazy real estate investor deals. And every now and then I'm going to do one where it's going to pay off in like 3 or 4 weeks or something like that. It's kind of not worth the pay forecast, so I just hold on to those. But all the other stuff that goes out there, I will typically send it out twice. It'll go out once, people will pick and choose, and then I'll send it out again. After that, I'll probably just keep it.
still something left on a given note. Are you talking literally the note, or is that a partial at that point?
It's a partial at that point. So you're sharing in that first position. So there's a note out there, I think I just updated earlier. It's $155,000. Oh, here, let's make it even easier. I did a thing this morning. Here's a note. That's exactly what's on the summary page. That note is posted on the board out there. So that note, that total loan is $148,500, mostly because I forgot to round the 500 up or down like I usually do. So you can see the loan-to-value on that note is 64%, under that 70% mark. So that's one of the things we want to hit. The rate is 10%, which is what most of them are currently. If somebody has the entire note, that means they're going to get a monthly payment of $1,237.50, and they'll have to write it in the register. I'm going to pick on you all day now. Okay. The after-repaired value on this one is $230,000, and we wrote it out for 12 months. Now, I know this one is a $100,000 rehab, so I already know there's a 10 or 15% chance it's going to go more than 12 months because it's a big project. It needs everything. Now, structurally, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with the structure. It just needs everything. Windows, roof, kitchens, bathrooms, furnaces, water heaters, electrical, replumbing, rewiring, take out the plaster walls, everything. So it's going to be out there for a while. So you see, I kind of mentioned that in there. The borrower is planning on selling this one retail. Now, the borrower has a little bit of experience. They've already done 10 flips in the last 2 years. And they're on their second loan with us because I sucked them away from Spring Valley Bank. Spring Valley is cheaper, but they're slow. So we get to bring them in that way. So here it is. You know, you've got a very typical profile of somebody that we're working with. And now if you wanted to buy a partial, so if somebody earlier said, hey, I wanted $50,000 on this note, this one here, there would be $98,500 left. So you could take part of that $98,500, or you could take all of that $98,500, and you would have that percentage interest available to you. So you might have 10 or 20% of the note, or 8.333%, whatever the math tells me. Mostly I ignore the percentages, it's just for putting on the form. It's, you have this dollar amount. So this is, but again, this is very typical of what we're going to put out there for a summary. I will also add, if there's anything special about this particular deal, this borrow, or anything like that, that is out of the norm, I will also mention that on here. Last year I put one out there that said, essentially, the guy who's writing the summary is also the guy borrowing this money. Because it was one that we were funding for ourselves. So I want to make sure that was very clear that this, in this case, it was me as a borrower looking to fund a deal, not me as an originator. Two very different roles. I think I passed the borrower background check. Pretty sure. But again, I want to make sure it's very clear. Let's see, what else? That was for Waterfleet. That was the one that's now our office building.
How did you verify that it was structurally sound?
We look at, we go out there, if they get a property inspection, we look at that. They send us about 100 photos every time. So we look at the photos on there. If I see something funky in the photos, I get to go do site visits. When we were smaller and slower, I did a site visit on every single house. Over time, we've learned that with the photos, if I get good photos from the borrower, if there's problems, we'll find them. We can see them. We know what to look closer at. Because we've evaluated so many deals.
Hey, Darren.
Yeah, Tom.
Just a question. Are you under...
Okay.
Use the mic, Tom.
Okay. In today's environment, are you looking to go into non-performings?
Non-performings are work. I'm trying to work less. At this point, if I was picking up a non-performing note, it would either be because I expected I could make it re-performing very, very quickly, or I would call Matt and say, Matt, I will partner you with you on this note. You go fix it. Or because I wanted the property. Making notes, re-performing, that really is a very active business. It can be a good business. It's simply not the business that I'm in.
Matt does that.
Bill, do you make any re-performing? Okay. So Bill in the back, he likes to do that. He likes to work harder than me. But again, it's the note business. It's a different aspect of the note business. So I found for me it works really well to have the borrowers come to me. I can vet the borrower. I can vet the deal in its current state. And I get really, I'm comfortable with the deal as it is today, because I want that interest payment just coming in every month. That's why I started doing this in the first place. I just wanted the interest payments every month. Just too much demand. I had to get help. All right, three hands at once. All right. Bill doesn't need a mic, but...
I'll just say, you know, I'm also a note investor. I'm Bill Griesmer. The way Derek does things is really good. Like, I forget the slide he said, it was loan to value. When it's lower like that, that's a security for the people that are buying his notes.
All right, I'll use it anyway.
We'll make the audio recordings. You'll be famous.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say... the way Darren goes about it, his underwriting standards and such, he's doing it properly. I look at an awful lot of notes, and on this note, for example, he's got a LTV, loan-to-value, of 64%. I've seen people selling notes for 90% before, and when you buy a note at that high of a loan-to-value, you as the note buyer, you're at a greater position of risk than buying something like this. Now, the 90% might pay better, it might yield better, but again, if you look at the risk-to-reward ratio, it doesn't always work out like that. So I just wanted to say, in support of Darren, he runs a good shop. The standards he uses are spot on, and he's a friend of mine, I mean, in disclosure, but I like the way he does things. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Hold on a second, Scott.
Can you give me an example of a note that went bad? You had to repossess the property, and if there was multiple people that owned the note, how did that process work? I just wanted to know how the processes work.
So the foreclosure process is the same as it is for any other note. So when something goes wrong, I go through three things. First, I want to try to get that borrower back on track. And a lot of times we're able to do that because they just got set off because something happened, they didn't know how to deal with it, or it was a temporary setback. So we try to get them back on track first. Second thing we do is if we can't get them back on track, we ask for that deed in lieu. So that deed's going to come back in. Once I have a deed in hand, hold on, you go third one first, is if they're not responsive there, now I've got to go through foreclosure. I got to call Ben or some other attorney and go through the foreclosure process. That's going to have an expense associated with that. So we've got to go through that process. In either the latter two, we get that deed back. Once we have the deed back, I'm going to look at all the beneficiaries and say, hey, we've got this deed back. Do any of you guys want the property? So far, the answer has always been no, because we're passive investors. So if the answer is no, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that property. If it didn't sell at sheriff's sale, then we wouldn't have the deed back. If I have the deed back, I'm going to put that property up for wholesale, up to sell wholesale, and I'm going to sell it to Mike over there if it's in the Dayton area because he wants properties, or some other investor who wants to finish the rehab. I might even lend him the money for it. So it might be something where, hey, you know, we took the deed back, so we have it, so your interest payments have stopped because nobody's paying. Oh, by the way, I'm going to sell it to Mike. He's willing to pay the interest. Do you just want to pick up where you left off? We'll do the loan to Mike instead. Or do you want me to pay you out, and I'll just originate a new loan with Mike? Now, every now and then, if somebody wants the property, let's say you had multiple people in the trust, and one of you, maybe it was Mike, because Mike wants to buy some notes, maybe he's on the note, and he wants the property. It's like, well, Mike, would you like to buy him out? And if you guys come to an agreement, he can just buy you out, and he can take the property. If you guys don't agree, I'm the trustee, I'm in charge, I will put it up for sale, and everybody can bid on it. And Mike may win the bid, or he might not.
Multiple people that own the note and multiple people
who
want the property.
Make me your best offer.
Hey, Darren, do you ever do either accruing or deferred maintenance for your borrowers? And if so, how does that affect the note holder?
Clarify what you mean by accruing and deferred maintenance.
I had a loan once where the interest was accruing, but it wasn't due.
No.
When it started paying for like 6 months or something.
Nope. I've had a couple of people that wanted to do that up front, and if you don't have enough money to pay the interest payments, you're not fit for this program. So, and the reason I do that is twofold. Okay, well, really, there's one main reason I do that. Those interest payments come in, that's my early warning indicator that you have a problem. So if I'm writing 12-month notes. If I have a 12-month note that says, hey, I'm going to lend you $100,000, you have to pay me $110,000 at the end of the note. If I know in month two that you're a problem, that there's an issue, that you've said screw it, you moved to Florida, guess what? The note's not due for another 10 months. I can't even start foreclosure until you're in default, even though I know you've skipped and run off to Florida.
Makes sense. Thanks.
So that's why I have those interest payments due every single month.
Question about the longer term rental. Are you going to escrow for taxes and insurance?
Unfortunately, yes. More bookkeeping and writing in registers and all that. But Scott's been patiently waiting.
Just want to let you know that you get OPHP credit for this, and you get 1.5 credits for contract law. I don't know why contract law, but that's what it says.
Wait, what?
Okay. I don't know. They make it up.
Just a quick thing. Did anyone know about the Ohio providing OPHP certification? You come here free every year if you collect these credits. I'll be doing the punching for that. You get 1.5 credits for contract law since you got to listen to him about notes. I don't know why it's called that, but if you don't have a card, I have extras. I'll just be at the front of the door on the way out.
Yep. Go ahead, Tom.
So I have a question about timing.
Okay.
Let's just imagine that, say, the economy had a big change in the near future.
It will happen.
How?
We just don't know when.
So I'm thinking, should I invest now or should I wait until we go over the cliff?
So it depends on what you want to invest in and what you're looking for. If you're looking to buy cheap real estate deals, now is not the time. If you're looking just to get some passive income coming in, 10% now is way better than 10% later. So one of the things I'm doing, because these loan-to-values, we notice I'm keeping down at 70%. If the whole real estate market drops by 10 or 15%, we still have some cushion in there. We're okay. And if I get in those areas where, like, we're in those lower-end neighborhoods, there's more cushion. Like I said, they have a minimum of a 25% down on the purchase. I lived through the last crash. I have the scars from it. So we are looking for that. One of the things we changed when COVID hit, it used to be 20% down or 10% or $10,000 minimum. When COVID hit, I actually thought our real estate was going to go down. I was wrong. But I changed it to being, okay, we're bumping it up to 25% down and a 12.5 minimum. I got no pushback. So I left it there. So again, we're building that cushion in there. If there is a drop, and I expect there will be one at some point, we're kind of, I can't say we're protected, but we're well positioned. Jess. Oh, give her a second. Get the mic.
Darren, thank you for your information this morning. It's been fabulous. My name's Jessica. I live in the Youngstown area, so I've been coming down to Aria since 2016. And I just wanted to share my experience in working with Darren. I have done a few rentals since 2010. However, with the notes, it's truly passive. I was tired of dealing with tenants and toilets. I actually became Venus Fast Track student because I had had a rehab deal going completely wrong. So I was hesitant about...
Pull the mic up a little closer.
I was hesitant about putting my money in because I had so little to start with. I found a person to partner with, and the first deal I did with Darren, he was, you know, giving me all the information, assured me. We did all the paperwork. The one was associated with my business and a partnership, so my business was funded basically, once the paperwork was done every month until the note was due, I got an extra $50 in my business account every month. And the second deal that I did, probably within about 3 months from that first one, it was associated with my Roth IRA, partnered with another person. So that was like a $200 a month check. So at the end of the month, you know, a little bit of paperwork, some time. He does all the research, and he's very thorough in what he does. And I'm very happy with him. So I'm doing my third deal with him.
Well, thank you, Jessica. Speaking of which, I have a Youngstown landlord Section 8 house I need to get rid of. For another one of my note buyers, is a landlord out there, and they want to get away from the landlording. They're moving more into the notes. So I've already agreed to trade a performing note for their Section 8 rental house. Now I need a Youngstown landlord to take the house off my hands because I don't want a Youngstown house. Oh, good. I'm sure you have a friend.
Thank you.
Let me add
hey, Joe.
Want to add one thing in here. I'm Joe Davidson. I actually work with Darren. I probably have the most unique perspective in the room because I was first a customer of Dayton Capital. And I've been a landlord for 35 years, been rehabbing houses, done over 80 deals in the last 15 or 20. The reason I started working with Dayton Capital is because as an investor, you need money when you need money. You got to be locked and loaded because things come up, especially now. You got to be able to pull the trigger sometimes in a matter of minutes. So you got to have things ready, and we do a great job with that. But perspective, somebody asked a question, I think, who's the typical investor? You're looking at them. We look at the background. I'm a loan officer, work with Darren. And we talk about, okay, what have you done? What are you doing with the property? And what's your scope of work? We talk to them about what they're doing and what their goals are. And because we've done, you know, a bunch of deals, we can screen that out. And that takes, it minimizes the risk. Doesn't eliminate it, but it minimizes it significantly. So now I've been a borrower. Now I'm part of the loan process. But I'm also now an investor in notes because I'm getting tired of, I got a bunch of rentals and stuff. I don't want any more, but I do want to invest in real estate and get the returns. So I'm actually a note buyer as well. So I went from a customer to using the product and now investing in the end result of that loan process. So I'm not sure there's anybody else in the room other than maybe Darren and Christina that have done all that.
But you're the only one that's become a loan officer for me. But there are several other people that are actually buying notes in the IRA and borrowing money on the outside to do flips.
So hopefully that is a pretty good endorsement of how we run things. And again, other people have spoken as well. And I wouldn't be here if that wasn't the case. So,
okay, so we've got 5 minutes left. So there's a couple of things. I told you about, someone asked earlier, funding sources, these are some of the things people have used to buy notes. So you've got the flyer there. That has that email address on there. It says guide@DaytonCapitalPartners.com. That'll get you back the guide, which is basically a written version of the presentation I've given you without that, one note on there. Also on that page is a PDF of all the notes that are out there, although it is slightly out of date because some of those are pending and sold. So you can use that email address if you want me to contact you or you have questions, you can send them the email address.